have to roll again.
Smallholder farming.
Yeah, and you?
You have more stuff.
Yeah? Oh, what do you all do when you teach manners? Oh, great.
Great. What part of the world do you operate in?
We operate in Mexico.
Uh-huh. That's fantastic.
Where are you from?
I'm American. I grew up in New York and live in Boston.
I went to BC.
Oh, yeah?
Okay, yeah.
It's a good college town, right?
It's a lot of people here.
I think we were starved, so be careful.
It's a young town.
Yes, it's our first time.
We were one of the originals. We brought up 5 or 6 years.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the very first session of the SCORE World Forum. Structuring collaboration. This is what we're talking about for the next 2 days. And I think I will start with quoting somebody who spoke last night at the opening ceremony, Jeff SCORE. Jeff said, "Changing the world is a team sport. Everyone has a role to play." And this is actually the sentence, the quote that was the most retweeted on Twitter in the past 12 hours. And I don't think it's serendipity because we're here to talk about collaboration. Because we all know that if we work together, we can achieve much more. We have 3 wonderful speakers here. We will talk about the way they have found ways to collaborate, the way they have structured partnerships, what new business models they have identified, the challenges, the risks, the opportunities. Before we start, I will mention the hashtag for those people who are on Twitter, on Flickr, SWF10, that's SWF10. We have a few bloggers here, so they will be reporting also on this session. If you're on Twitter, don't hesitate to tweet. This is what it is about. We have to share the information to the rest of the world. You may realize that in your program, I am being identified as being David Bornstein. I am not David Bornstein. I wish, actually, because he's a good writer. I'm not such a good writer. I'm Victor Dallon. I'm in charge of Social Edge, the online community for social entrepreneurs, a program of the SCORE Foundation. And this is where, actually, we learn about collaboration. And I would like to mention 2 resources before we start. Well, Social Edge is one. Right now, if you go to socialedge.org, you will see that there is an online conversation happening around structuring collaboration. Another one is an article that was published just recently in the most recent issue of the Stanford Social Innovation Review by David LaPiana, and the title is Merging Wisely, Mergers, Strategic Alliances, Collaboration, Partnerships. So it is in the Stanford Social Innovation Review. We have 3 speakers. They are 3 practitioners. My panel is already reminding me that I need to talk about mobile phones. So we talked about Twitter and the mobile world. Don't forget to turn your mobile phones off, pagers, everything. When we talk about questions and answers later, you will have access to microphones. And at 10:30, when we are done, please get out because other people will come in. It's not exactly what it says, but you get the idea. All right. So we have 3 terrific speakers. They are all practitioners, and they have a very valuable experience around collaboration. On your far right, Sue Riddlestone. In the middle, Andrea Coleman, Gary White. Sue Riddlestone is with BioRegional. And I was actually about to ask her what the exact name of the company was, BioRegional Development Group, and she's just told me actually that there are quite a few names. Tell me what all those names are exactly.
Well, we have BioRegional Development Group, which is the kind of the parent or the mother
company or organisation. And then there's bioregional mini mills, bioregional charcoal company, bioregional properties, bioregional quintain, bioregional forestry. So we have 8 associated companies. Actually, there's one that's not called bioregional. That's the laundry.
So we
paper clear, recycling.
We'll have a pretty good sense about your new business models. This is what we'll be talking about. Andrea Coleman is with Riders for Health, and there's actually a piece of information. So we're talking about motorcycle riding right here. She will talk about that at some point. Andrea used to be a motorcycle rider, actually a racer, I believe, so it's going to be very interesting. But let's start with Gary to begin with. Gary, please tell us who you are briefly, a couple of minutes, and see where we're going with water.org.
Okay. So, Gary White, co-founder and executive director of water.org. Water.org actually is all about collaboration and partnership, and last year even about merging. It's the essence of what we do. Before we were water.org, before the merger last year, we were actually called Water Partners. And the partnerships that we have, of course, extend to our donor community, but they also extend to the developing world, where we're helping communities implement safe water projects and safe sanitation. And, of course, being a U.S.-based NGO, it would be kind of ridiculous for us to think we could go into countries and do these programs ourselves. So we're all about finding local partners to work with, non-governmental organizations, putting them through a screening and certification process, and then building out this network of partners around the world. And then increasingly we're doing that in the context of microfinance institutions as we start to blend microfinance together with water and sanitation, giving small loans to people living in slums and in rural areas so they can get their water and sanitation solutions with the financial resources from the bottom up as much as the top down.
I understand that you have a video. Shall we show the video now? And there's a little clip and see the way it is structured, the way it works. Can you briefly talk about this video?
Sure. So short video about how water.org kind of lives this out in the field through one of our partner organizations, Grimalia, in India, and then also talking a bit about our water credit initiative as well. So we'll go from there.
And it's about 4 minutes long.
In India, only 30% of the people are using water and sanitation properly. Only 30% of the people are having toilets in their house. They are going for only the open defecation.
Water is such a building block. You can't really move forward with your life until you really meet the basics like water and sanitation.
The school children, we are using them as a health ambassadors to motivate their parents to consider toilets through them.
Sir, the toilet cutting, sir, very level, sir, palm pushing, cutting, sir, malakirimi, number that, sir, padam, sir, cut level, evakani, sir, malakirimi, sir, and the very people, sir.
Well, I think microfinance works so well because it allows people to get the credit tools that they need to improve their lives. The problem is you don't have the savings to pay for that toilet or to pay for the water connection. And if you can get affordable credit into the hands of people, they're going to make the decisions that are best for them.
The These banks are going, wait, this actually works. These repayment rates are at 100%. What, you know, I'll loan to them, you know.
The things that we're doing with the Clinton Global Initiative, with our partners that have made commitments there, with the Open Square Foundation, the PepsiCo Foundation, One by One, H2O Africa, those commitments have made all of this possible, particularly here in India. You know, we're ahead of our goals.
One thing about water credit is, it works so well, it's a little bit scary. When you tell somebody, when you make them aware of a problem this serious, but then also make them aware of a solution this practical, I think it's in people's nature to want to step up and do their part.
So, you know, it's really through those partnerships with Grimalia, with NGOs, MFIs, and donors that we're able to put this all together. And then the question about the merger as well. As you saw, Matt Damon is the co-founder of Water.org. Prior to forming Water.org last year, we were Water Partners, and we'd been around for about 20 years. And then we had this opportunity with Matt's organization, H2O Africa, which had been recently formed, to bring the organizations together. With Matt and H2O Africa, there was this incredible kind of value in terms of obviously marketing and media and fundraising. And then with Water Partners, we had this incredible, what I call the downstream value, being able to go out and build these local partnerships in developing countries. So there was a great kind of symmetry between the two organizations. And so Matt and I discussed this at length and decided to bring the organizations together. It's driving greater effectiveness, greater efficiency in the way the organization can work now. So I think it's you don't see it too often in terms of the nonprofit world with mergers happening, but this was one that happened pretty seamlessly.
Would you mind talking about the challenges in merging two organizations? Because I know we'll talk about the two other speakers, but you are just in the middle of merging two charities or two non-for-profits. I understand what the impetus was, but what were the challenges?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of kind of legal challenges to get over with the lawyers, but those those went fairly smoothly. I think the fact that H2O Africa was a fairly young organization and didn't have a lot of staff, there weren't a lot of issues around that, which can be very thorny. But culturally and from a mission perspective, we were just in lockstep. So I think that I feel very fortunate that this merger presented a minimum number of challenges. And from the time that we first discussed it until the time it was finalized was only about 1 year.
Andrea, so you were a motorcycle racer. Then at some point in your life, you launched, with your husband actually, with Barry, Riders for Health. Tell us about who you are and what Riders for Health does.
Thank you. Yes, well, when Victor asked me to tell you something personal about myself, I was very cautious because I know you all had late nights and you'll all be feeling a bit fragile, so I was careful about what I said. Motorcycle racing has champions. Now, I actually spend a bit of time thinking about what makes a champion. And I think that what makes a champion is excellence and their team. And a team really, of course, is partnerships. And in the work of Riders for Health, the work that we do in Africa to mobilize healthcare to reach remote communities to make sure that people don't die of easily preventable and curable disease, the champions for us are the women and the men, who the health workers who take that health care out to rural communities. When they're not mobilized, they have to walk. Africa's a huge continent. It has very little transportation infrastructure, and those people just have to walk. And that means that there may be 10,000 people that they're trying to reach don't get health care. They're neglected, they're ignored, they're isolated. And people are spending billions of dollars on drugs for the poor, for taking care of them. They are available. But if you can't reach them, it's not going to help. So our champions are those men and women who are trying to get that out there to reach them. But also they need a team behind them. And part of that team is the Riders for Health technicians and the people who support them and make sure the vehicles work, but also the money management behind it and the management of the organisation. So without those partners, the very focused partners around that team and that champion is very significant, and we couldn't do it. They couldn't do it without that team. So partnership is fundamental. And also, we're a partnership organisation. We're not health professionals. We are enabling people who are health professionals to get out there to do their work. You've heard speakers talking about the amazing work they're doing in Africa, but they can't do it unless they can reach the people. So we support them in doing that, and we are a partnership organisation.
I believe you, the BBC produced just a recent movie about Riders for Health. Do you have an excerpt here, a short video showing what your work is actually producing over there?
Yes, we're very lucky. The Skoll Foundation partnered with Rock Opera Productions, and Alvin Hall was our the presenter of the program. And this particular piece of film shows the work of our sample transport. That means that healthcare samples, specimens, urine samples, blood samples get to clinics and the results get back and then people don't die. So it's really a clip of showing the sort of courier system that can be run in Africa even in the very harsh conditions that exist.
Shall we show the clip then?
It all started 20 years ago. Back then, Barry and Andrea used to raise money for other charities that worked in Africa. They went to see how their money was being spent. What they saw shocked them. They realized a whole new approach was needed. Now they are bringing it to Zambia.
I saw a motorcycle that was new and gleaming, and it was completely dead, that had done 800 kilometres. And we know you could have 150,000 kilometres of healthcare delivery out of that, and there it was, dead at 800.
The motorcycle is low cost to buy, it's low cost to run, and public health workers and people who are running specimen transport and so on, you can't really afford to buy a big vehicle for everybody who needs one. They're also a single track vehicle. So, and many of the places out in rural communities are very narrow people and animal tracks. So a motorcycle can easily get down those. Making sure that everybody is mobile in this really difficult terrain.
They knew it wasn't Africa's harsh conditions that were the problem, but poor maintenance.
Inside here, we have our drive chain.
Their solution? Train local riders and drivers to carry out simple checks and preventive maintenance. The result? Hardly any breakdowns, no matter how rough the roads. In 1991, Riders for Health launched their first program. Today, they employ nearly 300 people in 7 African countries. They manage more than 1,300 vehicles that provide access to health care for more than 10 million people. This is Bonunka Health Center. It's 30 kilometers from the nearest town, but that journey takes an hour and a half by car, let alone by bicycle or on foot.
A lot of these people had to walk, and they're sitting outside on this porch waiting to see the nurse, the only healthcare professional for miles, for miles.
Helping the client means giving her the medication, which is appropriate. And if we keep waiting for the results and the disease is getting worse and worse, there's no help, there's no service we're doing to the client.
And it's all about transportation, isn't
it? Yes, it's all about transportation.
Riders aim to provide a health transport system that African governments can afford. They charge a small fee just to cover their cost. The fee is fixed for 5 years, so governments can easily budget for it. Riders mainly manage other people's vehicles, like those owned by health ministries. But these are often very old and expensive to maintain. Their new plan, which they've already launched in Gambia, is to buy vehicles themselves and lease them out. There are some tough challenges ahead, but I know Barry and Andrea are prepared to make difficult business decisions to ensure their social enterprise continues to deliver a cost-effective service and a great health benefit.
Now, Andrea, in this movie, I think Alvin Hall talked about the Gambia and the fact that you have a program over there. It's quite interesting because actually it's one of those partnerships that I would say is a model. The fact that you have received a program-related investment from a foundation, you're also partnering with the Ministry of Health, I believe, in the Gambia. You're also dealing with a bank in Nigeria, if I understand well. Can you tell us about this model? Because it is a model in partnership.
Yeah, it is, and we're thrilled that the Skoll Foundation has the courage and imagination to make an investment in Africa and in vehicles and in partnership with the Ministry of Health. Our resident genius, Barry Coleman, is the person who thought of this idea. And what makes it different, I think, is that if you run vehicles in Africa, they're going to last a specific amount of time, as in any environment. But if the ministries of health are desperate for vehicles, and even if they're very old, they become very expensive and really not economic to run. So to withdraw them from service at the right time to sell them on into the community as well-serviced vehicles is only possible if you own the vehicles. We also are able to control the riders and drivers and make sure that they are asset managers. Vehicles are expensive. There's a lot of money in those vehicles. So to own the vehicles is a very important thing for Riders for Health. But the Skoll Foundation we worked with them to look at how to buy all the vehicles that the Ministry of Health in the Gambia needed to reach every man, woman and child in that country with healthcare. And that was a $3.5 million sum. And we made an agreement with the Nigerian bank, Guarantee Trust Bank of Nigeria, which has a branch in the Gambia, and they loaned us that money. And they loaned us the money because the Skoll Foundation were able to offer the underpinning of that loan to work with us to do that. And we're able to pay that loan back by paying a cost per kilometre, charging a cost per kilometre to the government, that covers fuel, maintenance, all the issues to do with running vehicles on an outsourced public-private partnership basis. And then we pay the Skoll Foundation the money that they have underpinned the loan with. Or we pay Guarantee Trust Bank, and they then pay the Skoll Foundation. So it is a model that we think that, in terms of assets, can be rolled out not just by us, but by other organisations with using tangible assets in that sort of setting. So it's very exciting, and structuring that partnership, it's not just the structure, but it's the attitudes that go with it, the courage, the commitment to excellence and trust. And I think it's not just structure, but the attitudes that go with it that are so important.
Well, tell us, I mean, I understand it's not only about structuring this partnership agreement, but how long did it take you from the minute you envisioned this partnership and the moment actually it was moving, happening?
Well, I was talking to Ed Diener from the Skoll Foundation this morning, and of course we know that the partnership is running and rolling, and the whole model is running. We always have little skips of heartbeat on the way. It's not all, you know, it's not all plain sailing, but from the moment that it was conceived to the moment that we got it going was surprisingly fast, really, given all the difficulties, about 18 months. But we launched it in January 2009, and it's running well, and interestingly and excitingly, the Ministry of Health is paying 8 months in advance at the moment. So the skips of heartbeat are much, much reduced.
This is a very interesting business model. I think we have another expert here, Sue Ridderstone, with BioRegional. You have quite a bit of expertise in structuring collaborations with businesses and actually launching businesses as well. Could you just briefly tell us about yourself first and also about BioRegional?
Mm-hmm. Well, we started BioRegional back in 1994 because we were really concerned about the effect that our overconsumption in developed countries was having on the environment. And we have so much, we consume so much, whereas people in the countries where Andrea and Gary are working have so little, they don't have enough. And in fact, if everyone in the world consumed as much as we do in Europe, we'd need three planets to support us. So what we need is one planet living all around the world, you know, a fair share living within our fair share of the world's resources. So we thought, well, what can we do about that? How can we create products and services that produce the things that we need in a way that has less impact? And can we create communities where we can live a high quality life, but within our fair share? So we have a number of real life projects, sustainable communities, products, which are really showing how we can actually reduce our carbon emissions by the 80-90% we need to do in the UK, for example. And none of this, you know, who were we? We were just concerned people without any money in our pockets. We couldn't have done anything without the goodwill, the mentoring, the partnership and collaboration. Everything we do, we've done it with some great partners. And what we do is good in itself, but what we, in terms of saving resources, but the idea, the model that we have is very much around creating examples and then showing people how it works so that they can learn from it, and it can influence industry practice, it can influence policy change. And our probably most well-known project is the Bedstead Eco Village in South London. And that's a project that really started because we'd grown to about 12 people and we needed a new office, and we thought, well, we've got to have an eco office. And it just worked out that the local authority had a large site, and we thought, great, we can have a whole eco village and we can live there too. And that was back in 97, and the project was completed in 2002. And out of that, a lot of our work has grown, where we're now working with partners around the world, from China to Australia to North America, on sustainable communities, showing that one planet living is possible all around the world. For adding it up this morning, something like 90,000 people will be affected. So we have a short film to show you about what it's like at Bedstead, and then I can tell you a little bit more about how we went about setting up that partnership.
By the way, this is the last video. Don't expect more movies.
Don't you have one, Victor? Just wondering whether to start talking to you again while we're waiting. But, oh no, looks like we have... Okay, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project until the film comes on. So we had this idea, and actually the project cost £15 million, and as I said, we didn't have any money in our pockets. Oh, here we go. Oh, no. So we worked up a pitch, we found an architect, and here, you can see the result.
If everybody lived like we do in the UK, we'd need three planets to support us. BedZed aims to provide a community where people can live at the one planet level. It's a mixed-use development with homes, workspace and community facilities. It was developed by the Peabody Trust in partnership with BioRegional and Zed Factory. Okay, so we're in a BedZed home. People have been living at BedZed since 2002, so we're quite established now. BedZed really takes a holistic view of a sustainable community. It doesn't just look at the built environment, it also looks at lifestyles, so what we do with our food, transport and waste. In terms of energy use, we've reduced our carbon emissions by about 56% through a lot of insulation, some renewable energy supply, and also through resident engagement and energy efficient appliances. And in all the kitchens, we've got our water and electricity meters at eye level, so we're conscious of how much we're using. We have segregated recycling bins, so we can easily recycle glass, tin cans, paper, cardboard, compost, and even shoes and textiles. BedZed has great natural daylighting, so we don't need to use so much electrical lighting. Water use has been reduced by about 50% through things like dual flush toilets and low flow taps. Here's the UK's first and only biomembrane reactor. It takes all the effluent from our kitchens and bathrooms and cleans it so we can use it for toilet flushing. BedZed has a green transport strategy. We chose a site because it has very good public transport links. There's a bus stop just across the road, a tram stop this way, and the rail station just down here. We also have a car club for residents. Every car club car takes 5 privately owned cars off the road. Secure bike storage makes travelling by bike convenient. BedZed's striking wind cowls provide wind-powered ventilation. The plants on the roofs are great for biodiversity. And even though it's a really dense development, nearly every home has a garden. But the most important thing is that BedZed is a community where people of all different backgrounds enjoy living and working together.
So you can come and visit if you're in London. So I'd like to tell you a little bit, if I may, about how we put that project together. As I say, we worked up a sort of cost for it and some designs. The Sainsbury's Family Charitable Trust gave us a small grant to cover some of the staff time to work it up. Our local authority wanted to see a sustainable community built in their area. So I suppose you could say they were a partner too in that they were trying to help make this happen. And we took that project around to a number of people with our pitch, as it were. And we found the Peabody Trust, London's largest and oldest housing association, agreed to put up the money to do it. And I guess one of the key sort of points there is that it was a person within an organisation who had the decision-making ability and who agreed with our vision and backed up what we wanted to do. So Dickon Robinson, who was the head of development at the Peabody Trust, and he championed the project and kept it, agreed with it and kept it on track all the way through. So I think that's a key thing in partnerships, that you need a senior level decision maker who will really stick with it. And we worked with them as partners to deliver that project on the sustainability aspects. And I guess that's another element to successful partnerships, that both partners need to be bringing something useful to the project, and both partners or all the partners have to get something out of it. Otherwise, it doesn't really work. So we were bringing the sustainability know-how. We were also bringing grant funding. We were also going to be a client. We were going to rent our office there, and we were going to purchase property. That project went really well and was finished in 2002. So we now have our lovely office, and I live there. My husband and co-founder, Perun Desai, and my colleague Jenny are here. We work there and we live there. And it's been an internationally award-winning project which people come from all over the world to see, and there have been many lessons learned. It's not perfect. But it affects the people who live there. So Steve, who lives there, he said that he just, could you build another project, because I don't want to move now. I don't know where I couldn't move. Where can I move to that's going to be as great as this? People who live at Bedsteads, the point is they're reducing their impact massively by over half. So if we're reducing our impact, more people can have more around the rest of the world. And yet they're actually have an improved quality of life. So people at Bedstead know on average 20 of their neighbours, whereas in most neighbourhoods in the UK, or even over the road to us, people only know about 8. And the more people you know, the happier you are. So I think that's the great message, and that's what we've tried to replicate and scale up working with partners.
Now, I'm intrigued because you clearly seem to have a business approach to the way you're solving these problems, but you launched BioRegional as a charity, as a non-for-profit. Mm-hmm. What's the reasoning behind this structure?
Well, when we started to look at what we wanted to do, we realised that there was an awful lot of thinking and research that needed doing. And so we decided that if we set up as a charity, that would give us access to a greater range of funds. And also, although we're taking a business approach, we're not doing it for the money. And we wanted it to be clear that we were doing something for a social good as well. But on the other hand, sometimes as an exit strategy, it's very important that things are set up as a self-sustaining company. And we do have 8 associated companies that have come out of that. So that's kind of one of our scaling and continuation strategies, as it were.
Gary, speaking about business, I know that in this video there's some allusion to MFIs, working with microfinance institutions. Can you tell us about this water credit initiative that you have launched?
Sure. So from a point of view of collaboration, again, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for us to be effective working in developing countries without those types of partnerships. What we see with Water Credit is there was a reluctance to partner on the part of microfinance institutions because they didn't understand how you could make small loans for water and sanitation and have those be bankable. So how are people going to generate income to repay those loans? So there was this definite aversion to launching loan portfolios for water and sanitation. So we really had to make the case in order to get those microfinance institutions into our network and to partner. And we were able to do that. I mean, the fact that poor people living in slums pay on average about 12 times what their neighbors pay who are connected to the water utilities. Why is that? Because they have to go to the water mafia and buy water from vendors, informal networks. So they're paying a lot more than the people who are connected. The fact that most of the subsidies in water are pushed out through the pipe network systems allows those who can get connected to capture the subsidies. And the MFIs didn't understand that if we could just get a loan to people so they could get connected to the utilities, then they would be foregoing those expenditures. We knew this because people were going to loan sharks and paying 125% interest in order to get a loan to build a toilet or to get a water connection. So it's part of bringing the partners along in a learning process, helping them to understand that there is kind of a symbiotic relationship that water.org could pursue with these microfinance institutions. But even that wasn't enough. And from our perspective, what we had to do, we had to kind of put our money where our mouth was in terms of developing the partnerships. So we bring from, we raise the philanthropic capital in the U.S., so that we can bring that to attract MFIs with smart subsidies. So we'll help them as a partner fund their market research. We'll help them figure out how to design their credit products. We'll help them bring on board the right kind of staff in order to make this happen, with the intent that this partnership can be used as a model with key MFIs in different countries around the world, and then building a learning platform into that so that we can tell the story of how these things work or how they don't work in some situations, so that the partnership can become more viral, so other microfinance institutions can pick this up and start developing loan portfolios for water and sanitation. So it's about starting with the vision of knowing that water.org was never going to be the channel or the bank to reach people through water and sanitation loans, but we really had to work hard to get those partnerships in place so that everybody's working at their greatest, working within their greatest strength and greatest efficiency.
That's an interesting, actually, and that leads to a question to Andrea. Looking at the way you have structured the partnership, what's really the impact on the organization when you start working with different constituents as you are doing yourself now?
Yes, it's very interesting because, in fact, once you... I think also I should just explain why we felt it was important to work with a Nigerian bank or an African bank. We felt that really to test the model properly, we needed to work with a bank that was supported by the loan from the Skoll Foundation. And that has indeed been turned out to be very important to all of us in the model. The impact on the organization has been very significant. First of all, because to figure out and to test on paper any kind of financial and operational model of that kind is pretty strenuous. And so it was a mix of a collaboration in creating the model on paper between the Skoll Foundation with consultants, with our internal, our people internally and other folks. So that was quite a test of teamwork. And then from that point on, once you start along the line of not managing other people's vehicles, the procurement of vehicles is always done by somebody else. That's somebody in the Ministry of Health in Kenya or whatever it is. Once you start to own the vehicles, you have to do all the calculations to do with the finance, to do with the procurement, and all those other issues. So it throws a lot of work back into our UK central organisation, and so it does change the dynamic, if you like, of the internal organisation. But it also very rapidly builds your skills and competencies in terms of financial knowledge, in terms of partnership management, and it really kind of improves and strengthens your organisation. And to work with partners is so strengthening, and you learn so much. So I think it's been a very important development for Riders as an organisation.
It sounds also positive. I want to hear the challenges of partnering. Okay, come on. This is not PR here. Sue, you want to start the challenges of your partnering with other organizations? I'm sure there are a few. Come on.
In terms of sort of scaling the impact up from BEZ, I'll just set the scene a little bit. We've tried to do that in a number of ways. So by working with other people who come to us and say, can you just give us some advice? It ended up with us setting up a consulting arm where we're just providing advice, and the profits from that go back to the not-for-profit. The charity is developing its own projects, working internationally, working with partners, and I'll come back to that. But that's something that Skoll have supported us to do, and we've set up our own property development company. But one of our biggest challenges came on the work that we wanted to do on policy change. So obviously we built BEDZ and we thought, great, now everybody can learn from this and take on the good things about it. But many, many people came to have a look, but not anything necessarily actually happened. So I wrote a paper, all new homes should be zero carbon. We tried to get the Greater London Authority to take this on. And in the end, we started to work with WWF, the Worldwide Fund for Nature, because they have the connections, and we actually signed a memorandum of understanding with them, and they used this our work in part of their campaign for sustainable homes. And 3 years later, we did indeed get a policy that all new homes should be zero carbon just in 3 years in the UK by 2016. So that's a massive achievement that we made by working in partnership with an NGO. But we also found that we had massive cultural differences, and it wasn't always easy to work with. We're a small organisation, they're a large organisation, and it wasn't always easy. And in the end, we decided that we'd just back off a bit and work a bit more informally together, which we do, but it got quite difficult with us having our opinion about how things should be done, and they were so much bigger than us that they could call the shots, really.
Any difficulties around staff, actually, the staff on your side as well?
Well, I guess where we're working on so many different projects, and you know, you have your best staff, the people that are most experienced, sometimes it's hard to know whether they should be working on the third-party consulting work or should they be focusing on the charity projects where we're really trying to make a difference overseas. And, of course, when we set up the property development company, we lost two very experienced people to go and set that up. So there's a constant thing of training people up who can then go out and work with partners.
Gary, come on, tell us.
Well, to me, it's... I guess I would say the success of water.org has been determined far more by things that we've said no to than things that we've said yes to. Because it's, you know, we live in this social entrepreneurial culture, you know, this collaborative culture. Willie Foote, who's a school social entrepreneur, you know, talks about pathological collaboration. And there can be some positive aspects of that. But for me, it's about the trying to make sure there's real substance there in terms of a partnership or a collaboration, really trying to understand the value added by both organizations and not just, you know, it's really, the tendency is to tend toward collaboration and partnerships and joint ventures in kind of the nonprofit NGO space. And I think that, you know, we've really been pretty disciplined about saying no to a lot of things. I mean, we also really take seriously what is kind of built into our culture, and that's always examining the cost of collaboration, because there's a lot of costs that are associated with communication and collaborating, especially as you're launching a collaboration, and those costs have to be taken into account. So I think it's just really, you know, we've had some partnerships that have gone off the tracks, that we've had to cut some partners loose in the past, but fortunately that's been a very, very small percentage. We are constantly, you know, people are constantly reaching out to us to partner, collaborate, and it's, you know, the things that actually make it to that partnership in the collaborative role is probably, you know, less than 2% of kind of contacts or potential collaborations that we could get into.
Andrea, you mentioned something interesting about trust. I think you said a few minutes ago, it's not only about, you know, structuring the partnership, but it's also about bringing trust. And that's interesting because I know that on Social Edge, I mentioned there's an online discussion around collaboration, and it is actually a key question that's being raised as we speak in our live. Can you elaborate on this, the concept of trust in structuring any kind of partnership agreement?
Yeah. One of the challenges that Riders has is anything that in this current climate of environmental care and so on, if you raise the issue of transportation, people frown a bit. You know, are vehicles a good thing to be investing in? But of course, as Sue said earlier, it's very different between the developed world and the developing world, and overuse and neglect in terms of transportation. So we have the challenge of people rather resisting the idea of encouraging transportation. We also have the difficulties in our organisation of some of the big users of vehicles in Africa resisting change in terms of vehicle management. The vehicle costs a lot of money, and it really is an asset, and it should be cared for. But often people say, well, that's now not running anymore after a year. We'll just park it and buy another one. And, you know, that's, if you add up that money and what it could be used for in other parts of development, it's huge. But I think the issue of trust is so important in the Gambia, where, as we're talking about, we have the model, the new model with the Skoll Foundation and GT Bank. that didn't happen overnight. The model itself took maybe 2 years from start to finish, but it took Barry 13 years to develop a relationship of trust with the government of the Gambia in order to put that in place. So to scale up and replicate what we do, we couldn't possibly take 13 years to develop a relationship with every Ministry of Health in Africa. But it has to start with trust, an assumption that there is that working with government, African government, is a good thing to do, that there's trust on both sides, and to find ways like track records and so on to show that, to prove that you are trustworthy, but and that you have a mechanism that is useful to them. And I think one of the very fundamental things about social enterprise and public-private partnership in developing countries is that social enterprises, it seems to me, are the perfect partners for developing world government, because we're not looking at the bottom line. As Sue says, we're not looking for profit. We need to be sustainable. But we actually are thinking, in the case of Riders, of the health of the people of the country that the Ministry of Health also want to address. So our goal is their goal. And of course, the money has to be used in order to make that sustainable and to work. But actually, the goals should be exactly the same. That's what you should have.
I think the whole concept of collaborating or partnering with governments, especially in developing country governments, so many, I know NGOs in the water space, it's been the intent to kind of get around government. It's a very much a charity-driven model where you're kind of going out because the government isn't meeting that basic responsibility of delivering water and sanitation services. NGOs tend to kind of take the path of least resistance and avoid government. And I think that with water.org, I think we're really going to be flipping that around more and more as we go forward, because with something as basic as water and sanitation, you can't just give up on government. I mean, water supply in these communities, particularly in urban areas, is just a natural monopoly, and you have to find ways to partner with government. And I think that's one of the things about the Water Credit Initiative, too. We're not going out in these urban areas and kind of building out a parallel water supply structure. We're piggybacking onto the current government investment in these water networks and helping bring them paying customers. So not only do they get the connection fee from the user who took out the loan to start capitalizing the system more and improve it, they also get users who are connecting and paying each month for that. And so I think that there's this natural tendency in many cases to avoid government, but I think we really have to look for creative ways to partner and collaborate with them, and I don't think there's as much in the way of examples out there to point to.
But it's also to do with replication. If you avoid government, you can't really go to scale. It may take you longer, but you can't go to scale unless you're really partnering with government.
I couldn't agree more, and as I say, we've managed to change UK government policy, and in the other countries that we're working, that's our intention. And, we've changed other policies by working with government. And then you get that mass application, that mass replication is so important. Mm.
So tell us, actually, so you're talking about policy as well, and I know you're working with policymakers, other NGOs, you're working, of course, for the government, you're working overseas as well. Why and how? I mean, how did you structure all those activities?
Everything is always different. We have so many different models. It's more about we want to get something done, and then you just set up the right model to deliver that. So we tend to want people who are from that country or based in that country already to be taking on the work there, because they obviously have a much better understanding of how the system works and the culture. And that's, I think that's been one key factor there. We've actually set up organisations, bi-regional sister organisations in every case so far. But we are obviously partnering with other organisations in those countries to deliver it. And the way that we've worked with companies, for example, in North America to build a sustainable community or in Australia or China, is that we have a contract with them where we're set out what we're going to do and what they're going to do. And we're working to that. We've kind of formalized our process or standardized it. So we have this One Planet Living approach and 10 principles of sustainability from resource use through to social and economic issues. And we say we together, we have to write a plan for this initiative, this project, which we're going to commit to and stick to. And we will, in a way, be the third party independent endorsement of it as well. You know, you are working on this with us, and we will say this is a good project. And we found that's a way that property companies in China, for example, will feel that they can stand out amongst the rest. And so that's been the way that we've approached it in terms of working internationally.
We have not talked about the importance of technology or how technology can be leveraged in those partnerships. And I know, Gary, you mentioned something yesterday about a partnership with Cisco. I think it's an open source platform. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this. Is it what, ourwater.org?
Yeah, ourwater.org, O-U-R, our, dot water.org. And it's basically a platform that we're developing to give greater transparency into the water projects that that we support. So, for instance, right now a donor could track through the website where their donation is going, the impact that it's having. There's feedback from the field up from our partners to populate a database so people can track what's happening with their program in real time. We're just launching this. But there's another thing that we discovered that we could build off of that, and that is really with this whole democratization of information that's happening. You know, the fact that Vodafone has launched a $15 mobile phone, the fact that these service plans are really plummeting in cost for people living in poor areas. I just heard yesterday, I haven't checked this out yet, but I heard that more people now have mobile phones around the world than have access to safe water. So there's a lot happening in terms of the technology. And what does that mean to water? I think we talk about collaborations and partnerships kind of in a one-to-one context sometimes, like we're partnering with an NGO, we're partnering with an MFI. I think there's a potential to kind of break this open and have a one-to-many or a one-to-multitude kind of collaboration with people. So say, for instance, someone living in one of the communities where we have a water program that we've supported, they can get on and send a text message and populate the database that we have that will allow anybody to know that that water project doesn't work anymore. So the donor who gave money for that in San Francisco can get onto that same database and say, what's going on here? Why did I support this organization? Because their project isn't working any longer. The fact that so many people still get their water from tanker trucks, and women spend hours every day trying to figure out when this water tanker truck is going to be in their slum. And then they get there and they wait in the queue for an hour and then it runs out of water. You know, how can we use technology to help that person? If any of you are familiar with Disney World and the FastPass system there, the whole concept is you don't wait in line for an hour, you go and get your FastPass and then you come back 2 hours later and you wait for 2 minutes. So can we use technology and use GPS with these tanker trucks so that people get a text message when the tanker truck is going to be in their neighborhood, or when the public water tap, which only has water every third day, has water flowing so that people can optimize their time? So it's about not just this top-down kind of working through the NGOs, but how do we use that democratization of information to enhance the user experience of people who are trying to get their water and sanitation services.
Very interesting. Andrea, on your side, are you also using mobile technologies to better communicate with your team?
Yes, well, of course, for us, the mobile technology is the internal combustion engine. It's very old, but it's, you know, it is relevant. one of the interesting things about a vehicle is that it's a perfect monitoring evaluation tool. You know, the wheels turn and the odometer counts them, distance and so on, and you know exactly how much every kilometers cost, and you know how much the fuel costs, so it's all a perfect sum. You also know how much it costs to reach each individual as a result of that, and that's really excellent for us in terms of collecting data. But in terms of vehicle management, there is a lot of data to be collected. We need to, in order to invoice the Ministry of Health for every kilometer or the NGO we're working with, we need to collect data. And our technicians and the people who ride and manage the vehicles are often very, very far from from centres, from their country centres. So transfer of data is very, very important to us. We had a meeting this morning earlier with someone here from VPF and with the Skoll Foundation about satellite communication. There are so many areas that they don't even have electricity to generate. You know, they're still using generators. They're not on any grids. So electricity is a challenge, never mind getting on the internet. So so satellite communications and some of the rather sort of basic technologies that aren't as advanced as the things that Gary's talking about, of course those are relevant, but actually earlier technologies are still very relevant where on continents where they've been left so far behind by technology. So there's a mix of things. And of course, yes, we're using GPS and more and more. So yes, it's all relevant, but we're using some pretty, you know, dinosaur stuff there.
Sue, anything to add on this? I mean, I guess it's mobile technology is not really something you would use, but...
No, but I think in terms of sort of monitoring and evaluation, having some sort of system, having some targets and holding people to account and people committing to that is really important, I think.
Actually, monitoring and evaluation, that's something that, Gary, is quite important to you, to your heart, I would say. You want to know why you're doing this.
Yeah, so... Well, you want to know why, but you also want to know if it works.
Yes.
We have multi... Anytime you have a partnership that's engaged with funding, of course, there has to be accountability. There has to be some checks and balances on that. And, you know, we rely largely on self-reporting from our partners in the field to tell us how they're doing against the metrics that are part of the grant agreements with them. But we also then bring in external evaluators. We've worked with Stanford and Emory University to kind of go out and verify some of the things that are being reported to us. And our own staff also does field evaluations to make sure that we're meeting the targets that we have to have in place. And it's something that we not only use as accountability to our donors, but it's what we use as part of our learning platforms to disseminate that information in a wider way.
We have time for a few questions, and I know we have two microphones here and there. Before we ask the first question, I have one, actually. We talked about trust, but we didn't really talk about respect. Can any of you, talk about respect in establishing a partnership? Andrea, maybe?
Yeah, I think you know, the word respect for me is actually so fundamental to the way we all live that it's actually the word for me that means that the world works. If you respect each other and you have respect for what somebody's doing. I think that to build trust, you have to also respect the people you're working with and to understand. I think respect comes from understanding the point of view of, say, the Ministry of Health, if you're working with them, or the organisations you're working with. So I don't think you can have trust without respect, but it's actually a subject I could go on and on about, but I do think it's absolutely fundamental in a professional context as well as a personal one.
I'd agree. It's absolutely essential for a good partnership or a good collaboration that everyone has a good working relationship and respects the role of the other and what they have to do.
And for me, it's so easy to do that because it's this the humility that you get by working with your partners when you think you have a great idea and you're out there in the field with your partners and their ideas that tweak on that just blow yours away. You know, you there's this profound sense of respect for people in those relationships.
There's a question over there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Francis Njuakum from Cameroon. I feel so honored today to listen to Gary speak about water and sanitation and the wonderful work he's been doing with his organization in many countries. I have followed your activities, and I'm sure I've written to you once or twice about the extension
of
your services to Cameroon. We work in rural remote forested communities in very mountainous areas of the northwestern part of Cameroon. And I am so confident and happy today to know, because water and sanitation is the biggest problem that is faced by people in rural communities. Mm-hmm. When we go to these communities, the first thing they ask us is about water. And honestly and humanly speaking, you see the people don't have water. And in the dry seasons, there is no water anywhere in the hilly sites, because also the forest is rapidly disappearing. And I feel so happy that the work your organization is doing is really relieving and bringing such enormous support to people who are really in need of that. I just wish that one day you could find the opportunity to reach out to the Cameroon where I come from. The second one is that health, Riders for Health has touched the northwest corner of my heart, because transport is one of the most difficult things that most NGOs working in development in far off communities face. Most donors do not provide a means to for capital assets. And so I want to take the example of CDVT where I work. We run programs in forested communities, planting trees with children and elderly people. But one of the greatest things we face is that while we can have funding to cover our activities, it is usually not possible to have support to buy motorcycles and to buy vehicles that can provide monitoring and supervision and quick service to these communities. Of course, transport is an integral part of every development process. Without transport, it can cost like 2 or 3 days trekking to a community far off, and of course, you waste more time and you get there tired, you can't do anything, and you're coming back without doing much. And I want to feel so pleased, because I'm grateful to have listened to Andrea speak about transport. And I think this is the first organization that I see really solely responsible and supporting transport in these areas. I feel so honored. I hope that I'll have the opportunity to meet you personally and say thank you once again. Thank you very much. But also, lastly, I'd like to just say that working with non-governmental organizations has become one of the surest ways of reaching out rapidly to far-off communities. In Cameroon, for example, it would take a little longer if working through government to reach out to some of the communities. And sometimes government services take a longer time to go out to villages that are enclaved, those that are remote and indigenous. Sometimes some NGOs really offer opportunities for staff even to trek for days and reach out to those people. I hope also that partnerships could be established.
To your point about these rural communities, and they're so far out there, and I don't want to leave the impression that what we're doing in terms of water credit can serve all these communities. I mean, the fact is that there are people still living in extreme poverty, particularly in these rural areas,
yes,
that still need a subsidy-based approach. The problem,
yes,
is that in water and sanitation, for decades, we've assumed everybody is equally poor and equally needy in terms of having to be reached through subsidies and,
yes,
charity and philanthropy.
Yes.
And what we want to do is really segment the market more and understand that there's lots of people who could take advantage of financial tools like microcredit to meet their needs, so you can take so much of the subsidy that's going,
yes,
to the middle of the pyramid,
yes,
and direct it to the absolute bottom in these types of communities where you're talking about, until people it can get their first hand, their hand on the first rung of the economic ladder, and they can't do that if they're walking 6 hours a day to get water, and if they're constantly sick because of this. Girls aren't going to school. 443 million school days are lost every year because of water and sanitation diseases. So these rural communities really do need to continue to have those subsidies that help them with the capital cost, so that they can have a technology and a solution that they can afford to run in perpetuity on their own.
I think there's another issue here about working with government, that no government really should have some of the, and doesn't have some of the competencies that are available from NGOs and organizations like Gary's and Susan and Riders for Health. And we bring a very focused competence, each of us, to support and enable government. You're really enabling government by giving that, bringing your own competence to it. And also, it turns out that in working on our a leasing model in the Gambia, it turns out there is actually a lot of money being used on transport, and I suspect that that is the case with water and other things in ways that it's not working. So if you gather all the money together that's already being spent on something that's not working and focus it with core competencies on things that will work, then you're leveraging the money and making it work much harder and having a bigger impact on the community. So I think there are some issues down the road that we're all learning, but there's money there, but it needs to be gathered together and focused. I don't know if...
Absolutely.
We have more questions here and there, mostly on this side.
Thank you. In the private sector, collaboration is often facilitated by the fact that everyone more or less has the same objective, right, which is maximizing sort of profit and return. But in my experience, when you get into nonprofit and public sector, collaboration can be stymied by the fact that even though organizations or entities may have overlap in the vocabulary of the mission, the interests of these organizations can be slightly different. So, one may be focused on, for example, a literacy project that I know, one was more interested in curriculum and the other was more interested in a certain minority population and the third was more interested in scale. And so I was wondering if you could talk about an example where you worked on a collaboration where entities had slightly different missions or objectives, but you're able to overcome that successfully, to work together.
Gary, do you have an example?
Go ahead. You have each slide,
right? Well, it's slightly different for us in that our job is transport for health delivery, but where we have some a stretch potential stretches of our mission is that once you're running vehicles for a Ministry of Health, they would like you to run vehicles for other parts of the government. So and we can't do that at this moment because our commitment to our donors is such. But there are, of course, our commitment is to make sure that we do what the government needs, not what we want to do. And I think that's part of the respect and also having flexibility in what you do. And from our point of view, you can't guarantee that the health delivered is excellent. I mean, we usually believe that it is, but you have to make sure that you stick to your competence and place it where the partner needs the competence and hope that then, if there are any weaknesses in their systems, that they are then able to use their resources to do a better job in what they are actually, what their focus is. So there are some difficulties around that, and we certainly have to deal with them. We've never come across anything in exactly the same way that you're talking about, but certainly everybody's not immediately perfectly aligned.
You had a question. I'm sorry. Go ahead if you want to.
I was just going to just talk a little bit about, I mean, one of the things with sustainability projects is the for-profit mainstream will say, well, we need to be able to make a profit at this. So I think one of the key challenges of what we've done is to try to find ways to reconcile that and actually do things cost-effectively so that, you can make a profit, and that's where we're starting to get to with our work on sustainable communities, and it has an added value for them. So, for example, with the our associated property development company, Biregional Quintain, which is a partnership between a spin-out company from the charity and a large property development, mainstream property development company who are in effect the banker, and they have the experience in development, and we are bringing the experience with sustainability and the know-how on that. The project that we've just completed, or that Biregional Quintain have just completed, is selling twice the apartments, which are built to the sort of One Planet Living approach, are selling twice as fast as the regular apartments. So it was built to within acceptable cost ranges, and that's something that you have to work to try to find a common ground, and where people have an objection, like that to try and find an answer and a solution. And often that's why it's a good thing to be a charity and to have the support of organisations like Scott, the Skoll Foundation, because it gives you the resources to spend the time to work it out.
And I think to spell out what it is you're doing, you know, to say this is what I do on whatever educational matter it is, to be very clear about what it is you believe is the place you want to place your emphasis and get people behind that, I think.
Hi, Sean Holt with Own Ventures. I'm really struck by kind of the evolution here in terms of subsector or sector enablers that your organizations have become, particularly working with governments. I see Ambassador Bagley sitting next to me here. I'd like to hear more about the experiences you guys have and kind of the challenges working at different levels of government, from working with national level ministries to the more community-based local governments, and how, if you've experienced some challenges there in terms of the mission drift or the differences in terms of empowerment, if you will, at the community level, and how that translates into the work that you do.
Well, I think that what we try to do is we don't work through government so much as we work in collaboration with government. And in the rural areas, that largely takes the form of coordinating with government in terms of which villages, which communities are in need of safe water, and how can we as an external NGO working through our local partners impact that. And one of the best examples of that is, working through the local NGO to help provide the capital infrastructure to get a well drilled or to get a spring protected, with the local government's entities providing kind of the operations and maintenance backstopping. So the primary operations and maintenance happens at the community level with community trained technicians, but then the government provides the backstopping for more major things. That's kind of a very clinical way of kind of engaging with government, but a kind of a broader way is really looking at utilities and how can we as a relatively small NGO have any kind of impact there on increasing the efficiency and the effectiveness. And we do that, again, by not kind of coming in cities and helping people drill wells and kind of circumvent the whole infrastructure, but how do we work with the utilities to ensure that they get a greater subscriber base so that people who are currently stealing water from the utility because they can't afford to connect can become in transition into being paying customers. So those are the things that we're looking at. So.
I think for us, one of the issues is that donors or multilateral support to government in Africa often focuses on very specific diseases or aspects of health and development. So I think that for us it's important to work together with the government and the outside funders and the big NGOs, so that we know what the focus is and make sure we're all focusing our efforts and resources in the same direction. So local government for us is very, very important because our technicians and the people are out in provinces, in outer further regions, so it's very important to have good relationships with them too. And it's often for us also the entry point, working with the local government and then with central government. So they play an important part, but it's once again partnerships between local government, central government, and the players, as it were, international people around those parts of government that are, it's essential to partner with them, to talk to them and respect them.
Our experience has been very much that it's important to talk to people at the right level, and rather as with other partnerships, although it's difficult, it's important to build relationships. And I know that often in government people are moved around quite often because they don't want you to build up relationships, but it's about them understanding what you've got to offer and then being able to really hear and understand what you're saying. But what we often also find is that then when it goes to a slightly higher level, for example, in policy documents, for example, over the last 2 years, I've worked hard with the UK government on their eco-towns project and policy. And at the last minute, quite a lot of what we'd worked hard to get into the policy document got crossed out by someone senior who didn't understand. But I feel that we got 80% of the way there. And I think that's also the same with the Code for Sustainable Homes, which isn't perfect, but it's better than not having a code for sustainable homes.
There's one aspect of structure and collaboration that we have not talked about yet, and it's the personal aspect. A few months ago on Social Edge, we hosted a conversation on co-preneurs, those entrepreneurs who work together. Usually it could be two friends, two brothers, two sisters, sometimes couples. And it's very typical in entrepreneurship where you would have, let's say, Bill Gates and Paul Allen, you know, launching Microsoft, or Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak launching Apple Computer. And here, actually, sorry, Gary, we have two wonderful examples. We have two social entrepreneurs who have launched their social ventures with their husbands. And I think the husband's here. I see Barry, and I know that Sue's husband is somewhere here. So he's over there. Could you tell us about that? How do you structure a collaboration around a couple to launch a social venture?
Well,
yeah, of course.
I know what Barry would say. I know he'd say that he only does as he's told. That you hear him say that.
That's what Corinne said to you.
Yeah, it's not true, may I say. I think social enterprise is actually quite hard to do. I think most of us didn't know we were social entrepreneurs when we started. We thought we were. We knew we weren't business. We knew we weren't a charity. And you just end up feeling, you know, as if you're pretty odd and weird, actually. And, you know, we're just kind of different from everybody else. But at least there are two of you to reassure each other that you're doing okay. But I also think it is very hard. As Sue said, you start with no money. And so you tend to use your own personal money to get that going. And you couldn't really do that unless you had an agreement between the two of you. And I also think that you bring together a lot of strengths that the other, you know, the two lots of competencies are really very, very complementary. But I also think that there are ethical and legal and other kind of tensions. You know, people talk in social enterprise about the double bottom line. And as Sue's saying that, you know, in order to make things sustainable, you have to find sustainable income generation. But sometimes you feel it conflicts with the impact that you're going to have, the humanitarian or social impact you're going to have. So there's always a tension between that, those two things. And it's healthy and it's right. We used to think that some of the struggles and arguments that we have, and we do, are actually not a good thing. But we've decided that we realise that it's actually not just good for the keeping the what we do sort of pure, as it were, but also it's very good in our organisation that you don't have people sitting around all agreeing with each other, that you do have healthy discussion about, you know, the ethical or the way to go, the way in which you should take your organisation forward. So we've decided to build in our, you know, the arguments we have. We've decided to institutionalise them and make sure that everybody in our organisation has some element of that, you know, married couple thing, affection and respect, but also healthy challenges.
Trust, affection, and respect.
I couldn't add much more to that. I agree with what Andrew says. But the one thing I would add is being a social entrepreneur and trying to do the things that we're all doing, and many of you here are all doing, it is a bit of a passion and a vocation. It's not just a job. And having someone by your side who, as Andrew said, you know, who backs you up and believes in that, and you know, I think as Jeff Scholes said the other night from Alice in Wonderland, "I'll believe in you if you'll believe in me." That sort of thing, it gives you a lot of strength because it's not always easy pioneering and being out there in the front. So if you can find a good buddy in your mission, it's going to help. Marry them if it works.
Let's conclude, and I would like, you know, each panelist to summarize, you know, maybe the most important point to remember. Gary, please do start, and there's something that you said which I thought was very interesting. It's what is most important in some cases is when you said no as opposed to when you said yes. Tell us about this, and let's conclude, you know, the most important point to remember.
To come and distill it into the most important point. But I think that's probably one of the more unexpected points I could probably make, and I really have experienced that. And it's just this, you know, maybe it's the analytical engineer side of me that really wants to kind of step through these types of relationships that could potentially happen with us and really understand it. It really helps tremendously to have a great COO in our organization that helps with that as well. And just really, you know, carefully exploring all aspects of a partnership or a collaboration, you know, and study what's gone wrong. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but I've heard numbers thrown around that the majority of, you know, collaborations or partnerships, you know, cease to exist after a period of time. So, you know, study other people's failures to see why those things went wrong and why, you know, the things that you could structure would look different. I think that's, you know, learning through failure, especially if you can learn through somebody else's, is very powerful.
Thank you. Andrea?
Yeah, I really think that keeping your focus is really more important almost than anything. There's so much to be done in developing countries that, you know, it's tempting to try and do everything, but, you know, to develop your core competence, to develop the resources behind it, human and economic, is very, very important. It helps everybody to understand where we're all going together. So I think focus is really vital. But I also, you know, I'll also agree with what Victor said, and when he repeated what Jeff was saying last night, that actually social enterprise and doing anything that's going to work finally in development is a team sport or a team effort, and we have to be teams together and bring our strengths and you know, our thinking to it together. And I think that's what I'd like to say, really.
Sure.
I'd like to go back to that idea that it needs to be a genuine reason to work together, you know, with some sort of project in mind where you're both bringing something to it, or all the parties are really bringing something to it and really getting something out of it. Otherwise, it will start to fall apart. And to be really clear from the start, we're going to do this, you're going to do that. And maybe to start working on a small project together first. It's a bit like going out on a date, isn't it? Get to know each other, make sure that you will be able to work together. And I think finding a decision maker at the high enough level who will carry it through any crises that come up and keep holding it to the line is a really important in your partner. It's really important. And it's a relationship, and to keep that relationship on a good footing, just like you would with friends. Jenny, we were talking about it, and she said it's important not to pick your battles. Mm. I mean, it's just like a marriage. You know, you could bicker constantly about things which aren't important, but why? You know, it just destroys things. It's important, you know, to bite your tongue sometimes and understand that you might work differently if you want to see it right the way through together.
The conversation continues on Social Edge at socialedge.org, where we actually are moderating a conversation right now on structuring collaboration, so you may want to check it and actually contribute to it. And please thank Gary, Andrea, and Sue. Thank you very much.